Welcome, everyone, to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. I am your host, Jimmy Trana. Thanks so much for joining me. This week's show features an interview with ESPN's Tony Reale, host of Around the Horn, and, of course, former stat boy on Pardon the Interruption. Tony was phenomenal, came in studio, and there was a lot of Around the Horn, PTI, ESPN talk, but we got heavy, and we talked about Tony's battle with anxiety, which he's been public about. He had an unbelievable tragedy over the summer, losing a child during birth. He was supposed to have twins, and Tony opened up about that, and it was a really interesting conversation. A lot of things about mental health, and it's, like I said, it's not all heavy, but it is heavy at times. And I appreciated Tony's honesty. I appreciated his candidness, and I think you guys will enjoy the conversation. It's an important one, and he was great. So, no other stuff. I know there was a lot of anarchy last week with Andrew Marchand, Mike Francesa. I don't want to even get into all that. Maybe next week we'll have Andrew on. I'll see, but I just want to let this podcast end on its own and give you the interview with Tony Reale. So we're going to go to that right now. Tony Reale, host of Around the Horn on the SI Media Podcast. All right, joining me now from ESPN, a longtime ESPN host, Tony Reale, in person. Thank you for coming down.
Jimmy, this has been a long time coming. There's a handshake on a podcast, people. Just know it's there. I think I'm winning the handshake.
Tony,
I'm turning it around. I'm on top of the dominance. All right, now I'll give you the dominant.
This is terrible for a podcast. Tony was nice enough to come to the SI building. I've worked at SI now for, let me think, there's like 15 years. I've never seen any sort of fight or person having a meltdown in the hallway, and then as Tony walks in, someone was going ballistic. So that was in the lobby. Yeah. So that was a nice way to get
I wanted to intervene there a little bit and make cooler heads prevail, but at some moment, especially where we are in the world right now, it's better to watch it and make sure it doesn't escalate. And once it de-escalates, you let it move out.
Well, since you went there first with where we are in the world, is it difficult for you to do a show like Around the Horn, which, I don't know, I sort of feel like Around the Horn is sort of similar in the vein of like what I did with Hot Clicks, and now what I do is we're really on the lighter side of sports.
Yeah, funny. Absolutely.
You know, we're not doing like the X's and O's, hardcore, you know, baseball analytics. This guy's hitting 230 against lefties. We like the fun stuff.
Yeah.
Is it hard at all to do that in this time where the real world is sort of hard? It's hard to deal with the real world, and then you have to go into
it's hard to be in the real world. Of course, it's hard to be in any place where there's this much. You know, just I want to say up and down, but it's just, there's just a lot of down, and it's for somebody of my brainwave, it's being able to handle what is sadness, what is other people's pain, what is other people's tragedy. That for me is tough. But let's put that to the side for a second. I'm doing Around the Horn. No, it's never hard to do Around the Horn.
Right, right.
Something happened maybe in the last 10 years, 5 years. I think it was probably maturation of a couple things and evolving of a couple things. But as the host of the show, it was first and foremost in my head an evolution in my body. You know, I wanted to be a full person.
Right.
I wanted the viewers to see a full person. I think there are incredible hosts all over this field. I thought what I was best bringing to the table was I am a natural person. I want to be natural in all elements. So while we're going to buy or sell Odell Beckham's, you know, finger wag after his first down catch in a game, they were down 35 points at the time.
Right.
And like you said, be in the lighter space of all that. The greater idea for me every Around the Horn show is to have the most natural conversation possible.
Mm-hmm.
And to have any moment be real, you know.
Yeah.
And I've said that. I mean, so much is like keep it real, be authentic. I mean, those were all things that were catchphrases for people for a long time. But something clicked with me. We did a show maybe 10 years ago. I can't even remember the exact topic, but it was one of the unscored arguments that we, and I say we, but I really mean I, avoided for a good chunk of my first 5 years of Around the Horn. We're going on 16 now.
Right.
I mean, I've been around the block. I grew up on television, which is an interesting thing to do.
Yep.
Part of that growing up was at first not wanting to be on camera as much. You could ask Aaron Solomon, my producer, John Dersey, my director. I'm like, the focus needs to be on the panelists because that's what the debate's about. but also maybe while I'm comfortable in my own skin, I mean, I want the show to move, and I think coming back to the host all the time is not exactly what I want. Mm-hmm. In that vein, I wanted to not do arguments that didn't fit the mechanic of the show, the fun, blissful stupidity of sports debate, you know? Yeah. That's what I thought the show was about. But as I've grown older, I want the show to be about a lot of things because everybody's about a lot of things.
Right.
We all exist in multitudes, Jimmy.
And the challenge is getting the audience to go with you on that journey.
Right, right.
Which is
and
not
I
easy.
Thought, for me, the key to that was I'm going to put it all out there.
Yeah.
I'm comfortable being... here's a word that gets overused and maybe is often pejorative, but transparent.
Right.
I'm comfortable with being vulnerable.
Right.
I'm comfortable about showing myself on air. And I believe that's a strength of the show now that I'm comfortable doing.
Well, one of the reasons I wanted to have you on for a while is there's a couple of reasons. For starters, you always seem to be positive. There doesn't seem to be any negativity there with you.
Right.
At least that's what you portray publicly. And, finding those people in this business is extremely rare. And the other thing is, you know, in this business, sports media, I don't know, I feel like we're all connected in some weird, perverse way. You're one of the people, and there's only a few, I've never heard a bad word about. Everything's always been, everything I've always
people
heard
say
about
that. Talk to some intramural basketball referees. They're going to tell you otherwise.
So in this business, that's a tough thing. So I was like, I got to talk to this guy on the podcast. So let's go. Let's start from the. I don't want to do like a whole autobiography thing, but I know you went to Fordham, and then obviously you got to start PTI Stat Boy.
Yeah.
Now was that getting that gig? Was it hard to get that gig? How did that all come?
I don't even know. I have to step outside my body for a second and really consider what is hard. I knew I wanted to be a broadcaster since I was 5 years old.
Okay.
I knew I wanted to be a dad, and I knew I wanted to be a broadcaster. Those are the two things that were going to be, you know, where my life was headed since as long as I can remember. If I would have done that the right way, I could have said as far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a sportscaster. So went to Fordham because I knew the voice of the Knicks, the voice of the Giants, the voice of the Nets.
Yep.
Growing up, all went to Fordham. And, of course, the voice of the Yankees, too. So you grew up in this area. You know that Fordham has a little bit of a local, if not national, cachet when it comes to sportscasters especially.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty evident early on I wasn't going to be a play-by-play guy.
You want to do play-by-play?
Absolutely.
Okay, yeah.
There's nothing like play-by-play.
Right. When I was a kid, that was what – when I was 5 years old, I wanted to be Phil Rizzuto.
There's nothing like play-by-play. A basketball game, you're on the floor.
Right.
And you're playing that game along with them. I mean, you're just as tired after the game as somebody who logged 35 minutes. Love that pace. I don't know if where I was both as a broadcaster, but also – I remember – I mean, I got a good piece of advice. You know, it was from Marty Glickman, who was one of the Hall of Fame broadcasters who we were lucky enough to have mentor us at Fordham. Anthony, with that voice, you're never going to be on air. You know, and there was something to that. I mean, there was a little bit of Staten Island, New Jersey in that voice that would not be palatable to anybody's ears. It's the armpit of America as far as accents. But that being said – I was very much somebody who enjoyed the call of the game, but enjoyed the creation of the whole broadcast. And once I realized getting your hands dirty and creating the show or the broadcast was fun, I was all in. Now, I decided to not go to Iowa and call minor league baseball as my friends had done. Spiro Dinas was calling.
That's the part you don't know as a kid, that you don't just get into the Yankees booth. You
of
have to first
not.
Do like, you know, 20 years of minor league ball in middle America.
And that would be incredibly fun and would have been great for me. But again, that voice wasn't working.
Yeah, your pipes seem pretty good, though. You got the deep voice.
I worked with a voice coach for
a
little while. No, I did initially.
For
ESPN brought a voice coach to me when I was first starting around the horn.
It must be nice to work at ESPN, all the perks.
I don't know. Was this a perk?
I did not take it as a shot.
I did not take it in any
way. I think it's a perk. I would love a voice coach.
Yeah,
I
mean, name was Dave Cohn. He had actually called games for a while and had some acting chops, too, and he had a beautiful voice like this. And he said, Anthony, here's what we're going to do. We're going to talk in some riddles, and we're going to talk in some tongue twisters, and we're going to get you to open up your mouth when you talk. And that's when Irish Wristwatch came to me. So now, Jimmy, as I tell everybody in every dinner party I go to, and I don't go to dinner parties, I only play with kids now, but say Irish Wristwatch 5 times fast for your podcast listeners.
Irish Wristwatch, you can't even do it the first
time. Yeah.
Irish Wristwatch, you can't do it.
So it's
Irish,
things like
Irish
that. Irish wristwatch. The rascally Russell Westbrook wears an Irish wristwatch. Yeah, the wily Russell Wilson. Things like that. got me out of whatever it was I sounded like, and I can't even duplicate what I sound like. I guess you can listen to my brothers, and you can hear what that was. So this is a really long story to get to a point that...
How'd you get to around PTI?
I wanted to be on air, but it was pretty clear that may not have been a direct route, and I was comfortable taking a route where I could research, I could write trivia questions, which is what I did for the two-minute drill. I could write sportscasts, is what I did for Sal Marciano and the late Sean Kimmerling for Channel 11, which I enjoyed, seeing how a nightly show got put out. And I joined on with Eric Rydholm and Matt Kelleher a couple weeks, maybe a month before launch of PTI, and sat down with Tony and Mike, fully expecting to be their researcher, which is how people get in the business. People on air have gotten in the business. Mike Francesa got in the business this way. I wasn't blind to what that was, but I also wasn't really thinking about I'm going to be the next host of PTI once I start researching really well and give them the
Once these guys leave, 16, 17 years later, they're still there.
About a week before airtime, I was fooling around on set with the guys and then off on set without the guys. And there was clearly a little bit of shtick and personality that I think Eric and Matt and Tony and Wilbon fell for. I mean, I think Tony really liked that I confronted him and opposed him, which is basically, you know, how we grew up in this area.
Right.
You know, that's a New Jersey cookout.
Love to argue and debate. See, people say argue or fight. I look at it as debate and discussion.
Right.
And that's one of the things that sucks about Twitter is maybe someone, you know, may tweet someone. Here's the thing. If I don't like the person, I don't respond to them. But if someone I like says something on Twitter that I disagree with, I'll come back with a shot. And people right away are like, oh, fight. And I'm like, no, this is just how it's done. It's just a discussion.
You're 100% right, Jimmy. Here's something I learned after 3,600 episodes of Horn and then, of course, being on Twitter, which I keep a very comfortable stiff arm from. And I'm all right doing that as well. I treat it like it's an on-air broadcast every time I'm on it.
Yeah.
You know, everything I post, I'm going to be happy when somebody looks it up 3 years later. That's what's in the back of my head.
I have the complete opposite approach. I'm like, I'm not on SI.com right now, so let me let it fly.
You let it fly, yeah. You lose control of your message the second you put it out in air and in space. People can do whatever they want with your message, and you can defend yourself afterwards, but even that is an uphill battle.
Yeah.
So it's a toothpaste out of the tube scenario. This is when I write a script on Around the Horn. This is when I speak off the cuff at the back end of Around the Horn. This is whatever my intentions were. And of course you can make, you know, connections to how anybody communicates in the world right now. But whatever your intentions were, people can take that and go someplace else with it. You have to be prepared to live in that space a little bit. And that's what I recognized from Horn, you know, within 5 or 10, you know, years of doing the show. Mm-hmm. I need to... You know, be aware of how I strictly deliver my message.
Yep.
I think for me, to get back to the first question you asked, how did I get on air, but also, you know, the idea that you're nice. I was somebody, of course, growing up in a family of five, pleaser 101. You know, I wanted to be the good boy. I mean, I got in trouble so rarely, I can't even...
Really?
Somebody once asked me, you know, what was the worst thing you did as a kid? I mean, we don't need to dredge up any of those things, but it was embarrassing when I announced that I scribbled in curse words on my Uncle John's Christmas mural that he painted onto the window.
Wow.
You know, that was it. I was the kid who ruined Christmas. Did you hear about that?
Christmas.
1986. I ruined Christmas. So that's pretty bad. I think I'm being underrated about how bad I am.
So I would say the worst thing I did as a kid was... I didn't go to Catholic school, but I had to go to religion class like once a week leading up to, like, you know, your communion, confirmation, that type of thing. And there was one night I didn't want to go because I wanted to watch a Knick game. And I faked falling down a flight of stairs to the basement and spraining my ankle so I didn't have to go. So it's funny that you would desecrate Christmas. I would desecrate my religion class.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, we're in the same space there. I mean, let's delve deep into my psyche for a second. You know, I mean, I certainly wasn't. I mean, everybody has an impression of somebody when you see them on TV, maybe, or when you see them in person. I was not a four-star athlete in high school. I would have liked to be, but I grew very late. I certainly wasn't dating in high school. I wasn't really – I was a pleasant, happy person, and people liked maybe being around me. But it wasn't like I was trying to cause a ruckus or anything like that. And I knew what that was. I was comfortable living like that. I think what I would define now as niceness, I would prefer is kindness. I mean, I think there's a difference between niceness and kindness. Yeah. There's a layer that is so much deeper to kindness, and that's where I want to exist in now. You know, I want to. I mean, there's the expression, it's a lot easier to be nice than it is to be whatever the opposite of nice is, and that's true. But if I'm going to elevate what I do in my mind, right, host of a TV show, but in my mind, I'm turning out art every day. I'm Scorsese, you know, working on 16 different shots with a red light in slow-mo with somebody needing to go get the papers. You know, I want to amplify voices. I want to have equity and representation of voices. People say it's diversity. I say it's representation. I mean, it has to be representation. I want the diversity of opinions. I want all that, because that, to me, is still the most natural conversation.
Right.
And whether my life was based on being the happiest person in the world, and it was, through age 30, maybe, 35, I think as I grew older, was in the business, but then, of course, became a parent, I recognized it's not about being happy or exuding happiness. It's about living the most real moment at every time. You owe that to yourself. You owe that to your family, you know? You can't be blissfully everything.
Right.
Because that is not going to be good for you in the long run.
Right,
that's
not life.
Yeah. And that's where I was, I think, for a while.
How old is your oldest?
Francesca's 4. Enzo is 4 months.
And you turned 40 this past year.
True.
So you were 36 when you had your first child.
Mm-hmm.
So did this attitude sort of happen when you had your first child 4 years ago? Was it starting sort of in your earlier 30s? I do think once you hit 40, I'm a couple of years older than 40. I do think once you hit 40, sort of everything changes in a way in your brain.
But I don't even want to apply this just to, I feel this every day.
When you start on PTI,
yeah.
This attitude probably was a little
PTI,
bit different.
I was a tornado of energy,
right, you're trying
and
to
creativity.
Start your career.
I think a vortex might be how Matt Kelleher and Eric Rydholm might describe what that was. There was a lot of what we just talked about before.
Were you one of those
New York cynic or just somebody happy to oppose for an argument and really kick it up a notch in the office, which was something maybe that office needed, I think, at that moment.
Sometimes that could be annoying, too.
Yes, and I think I definitely stepped on a line there, but I was always aware of how to bring it back. I always knew when I was overstepping because I wanted to be liked. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's it. And in your 20s, we're talking about ages now, and I wanted to say this. I think about this a lot when I'm on air. It's affected how I broadcasted, especially my last year, which I'm sure we're going to get into, some of the difficulties I've had in my personal life, tragedies we've had in our personal life. But I know who's watching my show. Mm-hmm. We get the demographics. And I know what a 15 to 25-year-old young man and young women, what is out there in the world, what they can see in the world. And I, as grandiose as this is going to sound, I'm comfortable putting myself out there as another option in how to demonstrate how to have emotional balance or emotional up and down, or how to live authentic moments, how to publicly grieve, how to publicly be comfortable enough with your vulnerability where you're not demonstrating weakness, mm-hmm. you're actually demonstrating that it's strength.
Right. Well, listen, it's not you demonstrating weakness. It's someone who is clueless interpreting that as weakness. It's not.
No. But the idea of that is, and I don't even qualify it as weakness. A 15 to 25-year-old who's watching around the horn doesn't know what's weakness, doesn't know what's strength. But certainly there is a baseline out there of, I don't need to let people know all my feelings.
Right.
And yes, you do not need to let people know all your feelings.
Right.
There's too much information.
Right.
But I felt it was important for me to be in being the most authentic host of Around the Horn on TV while discussing Odell Beckham, buy or sell, pointing. There is still, for me, a place where that needs to be a real natural conversation. Right. We've done stories in the last 2 or 3 years that I have sought out. I wanted to do USA Gymnastics.
Right.
which is a topic, and I've talked, of course, to my guys at PTI before about this, Eric Rodham, just recently. That was something that they didn't really touch on so much because that story was lacking. We gave our first view of this, and our first view of this, of course, is very much the popular opinion. This is terrible. This is, you know, everything that it is. And it's difficult then to think of, well, how are we going to approach this on the second day, the third day?
Right.
And I think we did USA Gymnastics 4 days in a row because I felt like it was something everyone needed to hear and they constantly needed to hear it, and just moving on from it was not doing it
justice.
So
when you want to do USA Gymnastics 4 days in a row, do you get any pushback from ESPN on that? Or are you now, I mean, you've been with ESPN since 2001, around the horn since 2004. That's a long, long time. Is it? Can you basically call your shots now?
Jimmy, I have not heard from Bristol in any way over topic matter my entire career.
Well, that's the best. You're in this business, that's the best thing, when you can do what you want.
And you'll see tweets where people, like, they want you to. Not once I have gotten support.
Right.
I've shown up on television with an Ash on Ash Wednesday.
Right.
For 17 straight years on a show with PTI, with Tony Kornheiser and Mike Wilbon, neither share my faith, but were happy to live in a space where I could share my faith.
Well, that's one where I think
Around the horn.
They don't have a choice there, because if they said something about that, there's like a lawsuit waiting to happen.
You know what? I never really think of it like that, and maybe that is more of a direct way of what that is. But
when you can do the topics you want, that is such an unbelievably awesome freedom to have in this business.
I definitely do not take that for granted. Yeah. I think that's earned. I think that is earned by Aaron Solomon and Josh Bard and myself. I think Eric Rydholm, who's our executive producer, gives us incredible
feedback.
Birth. Space to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, there are days we'll check in and we'll say this is where we're going. There are days we won't necessarily have that conversation in advance because we know we have the birth to do that. But for me, I could not. I mean, how am I still hosting Around the Horn 16 years later? For me, it's 15 years later, 14 and a half. It's
obviously
because
the audience. That's why.
Well, the audience is, and that's how the show deserves everything that it's getting in its relaunch coming up. Mm-hmm. The new look, the new approach,
November
the new
5th.
Breath. Thank you very much,
we'll
Jimmy.
We'll talk about all that stuff, I promise.
It deserves absolutely all that and more. Yeah. But I'm saying for myself, to continue to be doing work, a daily show, which can be a grind for a lot of people, although I'm the type of person who likes a daily show. I like hands in the every show. I like to live in that space every day. Stick the landing or not stick the landing and say, as we always said on PTI, we'll try to do better again tomorrow. I like living that existence rather than going into a hole and doing a documentary for 4 years. But I also appreciate that while I'm navigating all that, I can evolve as a person and the show can mean different things for me through those 15 years. And that's how I'm still hosting Around. The show means something different to me now. It meant buy or sell. Whatever the geekiest sports conversation we could possibly have the first 5, 7, 8, 10 years of the show. It meant I'm in a place now where I want to have a more authentic conversation. We need to bring in more authentic voices, more representative voices. And then it meant more representative stories.
Do you ever have days, because you've been doing this so long, I know I have days now, where because I guess I've been doing, like you mentioned Beckham. Like last week there was a thing, or 2 weeks ago, with like Odell Beckham doesn't like to drink water and everyone was going crazy. Now, when I saw that story, I'm just like, you know what? I don't give a shit. I just don't give a shit anymore. I can't, like, I don't.
That's the good stuff, Jimmy.
You never have a day like that?
Jimmy, that's the good stuff. I have stories like that, absolutely.
Right,
I have stories.
Right.
I mean, I think we were trying to do a story recently where Cam Newton won NFC Offensive Player of the Week. Mm-hmm. And there's a debate that he had the first 3 quarters were terrible. This was the Eagles game. Mm-hmm. But then he had 220 yards and 2 touchdowns and won a game at the defending champs' house in the fourth quarter.
Yep.
The NFC Offensive Player of the Week, boo, boo. I don't even need to do that topic, that conversation. Nobody's having that debate in their dorm room, in their sports bar. And that's kind of, you know, story topic 101, who's having this conversation?
Right.
Is this a real conversation? So that's the type of topic I punt on, and I will air that out, and I'll air it out. And I think usually, if you want to get back to me being nice, maybe not the nicest words. I have a lot of energy. You know, and yes, that can come off in any number of ways, and I know what that is, and I constantly am fighting my own, you know, good angel, bad angel, and walking that back a little bit as I get too energized to shut down an idea in advance. I mean, that's, of course, what...
But as long as you're doing it in nice... Like, I would just say, like I said, I would just be like, listen, I don't care about this. Leave me alone.
Oh, come on. Water? That's the good stuff. Well, here's what we're trying to do, Jimmy.
Odell Beckham at that point. Like,
you
like
are.
Five,
you are.
Odell, 5 weeks in a row of Odell Beckham stories. It got to the point where I was just like, I can't. I just,
how does somebody host Around the Horn for 3,400 episodes straight, right? Okay. It's because I'm finding new ways to feel like I am striking on what I believe is the core of television, making relatable, unpredictable moments. Right. Relatable now, for me, this keyed into me with PTI, all right? Best debate show in television history, period. Not sports debate, not debate show, best TV show of its kind in television history. Well, what do you want to pose with Crossfire? I mean, where are you going with that?
No, I would say Bill Maher. And Ebert? Bill Maher would be the only one that would.
Good luck with that, all right?
That's a good debate show.
Yeah.
PTI is too, I'm not taking away from. But you said in all of television.
Okay.
So I got to push back a little. Just
talk to me about the pace.
In sports,
the pace,
yes.
of PTI, yes. The accountability of PTI. Is Bill Maher demanding the accountability that PTI did when it had a segment in its show correcting the mistakes? That right there.
They should have that, though.
Every show on television should have
absolutely.
That, Jimmy.
I agree.
And that's what elevates PTI in another way. Not, but back to what I think is the core of TV, what struck me and what I'm trying to do every day again, along with that natural conversation. Relatable and unpredictable. Tony and Mike, that's a relatable thing. That's two best friends.
Right.
That's a married couple. That's two brothers talking, two siblings talking. They're having I recognize this 2 days in when they were having a fight over
like
Dominique Wilkins versus Dennis Johnson, two guys retired from the league 20 years earlier, and they were still having the same fight they were having that they were having in the Washington Post newsroom
like
20 years ago.
That's like the Mike and the Mad Dog thing, where it's all about the chemistry and the authenticity. With Mike and the Mad Dog, and I think I would say this with Tony and Mike. You know they're not making it up. You know they're not just taking the side to take the side.
Yes.
This is what, you know, I get into this because I'm not a huge debate show person in sports, not when it's when you can tell that a producer said you take.
Well, we're on debate show 137 now,
right?
And
that's
that,
what it is,
and that
right.
Of course we all recognize what that is. But to your point, there was a light bulb for me, or there was a confidence that I had after hosting the show for whatever it was the first couple of years, where I knew. I mean, we're a show with a mute button. We're a show with the scoring system. I would hazard to say an immaculate mute button and an impeccable scoring system, but you might have your opinion on that. I also recognize that's meta-referential, and there's a wink with that, and not everybody sees that wink all the time.
Right.
They don't see it with every panelist we have on the show all the time. There's some panelists they allow it for, and some panelists they say, well, he's just making up the argument to go the other way. But I recognized that was not a space I ever wanted Around the Horn to live in anymore. We're not going to be that show. That was the greater evolution of sports debate shows. There was a lot of theater, I think, initially in Around the Horn when we came on. And I, though I am a ham and I like performing, recognized we're going to be buttering our bread, not with theater per se. We're going to be doing it tonally with relationship and dynamic that is relatable and then unpredictable to people. Relatable in that it's the dorm room discussion.
Right.
Relatable in that it's the bar room discussion. It's the golf foursome, or it's just Thanksgiving dinner, or the pinochle table. You know,
pinochle. Does anyone play that anymore?
Well, this is people ask me, where did Around the Horn come from, and I didn't create the show, but I'd certainly define what its evolution was over the last 15 years, along with Solomon and Bard, and that's. You know, I wanted to recreate those arguments we had at my Sunday dinners growing up, you know?
Now, you mentioned, what did you say, 3,000 and something shows?
This will be 3,601 when we relaunch
now,
on November 5th.
Right, and I probably shouldn't ask you this considering, you know, there's a relaunch you have to promote. But you've done this a long time, and in TV, people seem to move around and always try to, you know, they get tired of a gig. Do you see yourself getting tired of this? Do you see this going on for more and more years? Is it? Do you have a plan in your head?
Or? I have plans.
Okay.
I definitely see this going on. I think this relaunch, and again, it's not rebranding. I mean, we are recreating a show here that was in 2002, innovative and even futuristic for 2002, and then the world caught up, and then the world went someplace. And let me tell you what this relaunch is real quickly. I mean, if we were a 57 Chevy or a classic Corvette, I mean, we put some wings on the car and we're flying now. I mean, this is, we've taken it to a new reality, which is something I've talked about for years as a joke in the office. I mean, I always wanted to get people to be able to score the argument along with me, or I wanted to get the mute button on the street
right.
to the people.
Yes,
I mean, that's the fun of the show. You would love a mute button.
Absolutely.
With your guests that come in here,
no,
with your people
coworkers.
Out in the hallway,
yeah.
with whatever it was we walked into outside time, outside the office at Sports Illustrated.
Yep.
That's going to be a part of the layer of what we're doing here. The viewer is going to be able to be on our app and be able to score the show along with me or against me while it's happening. But even before that, I mean, we're taking the show to a new augmented reality.
So you're reinvigorated with the relaunch.
I am absolutely that. I think all our panelists will be too.
Yeah.
I think the show is about a couple of things, but it's got to be about being smarter and faster, and it's got to be about pace.
Right.
It's got to be... first show with a mute button and a scoring system, we should embrace that mute button and scoring system.
Agree.
And I think the augmented reality and the way it's going to immerse a viewer and it's going to immerse the panelists in a different way is going to lead that, to that type of discussion.
All right, everybody. This episode of the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast is sponsored by Lightstream. Let me tell you about Lightstream. If you have big credit card debt, and have you ever looked at your statement and been shocked by the interest rate, Lightstream is for you. Did you know you could actually roll all of your credit card debt into one monthly payment at a lower fixed interest rate with Lightstream? It's great because if you have multiple credit cards that have a balance, you just roll them all right into one with Lightstream and you get that low APR. And it makes it easy to do everything and pay off. Lightstream offers credit card consolidation loans from 5.89% APR with AutoPay. That's lower than the average credit card interest rate of over 18% APR. Big difference, 18% APR, Lightstream 5.89% with AutoPay. You get a loan anywhere from $5,000 to $100,000, and you can get that money as soon as the day you apply from Lightstream. My listeners will get a special discount on top of Lightstream's already low rates. The only way, though, to get the discount is to go to lightstream.com/SIMedia. SI.com/SIMedia. That's LIGHTSTREAM.com/SIMedia. This is subject to credit approval. The rate includes a 0.50% autopay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Once again, visit lightstream.com/SIMedia for more information. You said you know in your head what you want to do. Do you have, I won't ask you for like a specific, but do you know?
I have treatments in Google Docs right now.
Do you know how much longer you want to do around the horn?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think I'm going to do both. I think I'm going to live in a space where I can.
When you say both, what's the other thing?
The other thing is going to be the type of television that I love watching that is not sports debate show.
Okay.
It will not be a sports debate show. It will be a show that
will be sports.
Is going to be using sports as a thread, and it's going to be a show based on humanity. It's going to be a show based on people at inflection points in their life. It's going to be a show based on people who have to grieve or have to learn how to show emotion or have to find their inner strength or have to deal with parts of their life that are now exceptional, and I use the word exceptional in a positive way, where things now you can possibly see how things you may have previously thought of as disadvantages can be something that makes you exceptional.
Right.
It's going to be relentlessly positive because that is who I am.
I know that from the top. That's what I said.
And it's going to be relentlessly uniting, and it's not going to be a debate show. It's going to be about humanity. That's what I will do once once the relaunch gets underway and we feel comfortable with this.
That will be a reality show.
Right. Of course, it'll be ESPN show because I'm very happy at ESPN.
Good.
They've given me every opportunity in the world. I started off as a researcher, Jimmy.
Right.
I was researching trivia questions for ESPN's 2-Minute Drill.
I feel like
I'm the host of a show now for 3,000 episodes. I've been on TV every day for 17 years. This network has invested in me in an incredible way.
Yeah.
And they invested in me with very little data. But if I had to ask what they saw in me, it's what I had already saw in myself.
Right.
And that is the most you can ask of anybody in the world and any employer in the world.
I feel that's, again, not to harp on this, but I do feel like we have so much in common from that. I think we have many differences, but we have so much, because when I started here in 2000, my first job was typing up stories from the magazine into the computer system. That's how long I've been here. Yeah. And I don't know why, I don't know how, but they let me sort of grow and do my thing. And, you know, had a good run here. So, like, it's when you get that.
You've had a
very
great run here.
It's a very.
And now you're doing something that's in your heart. You're getting to talk to people one-on-one.
Right.
And we're having a conversation here on a sports media podcast where sports has come up about three times.
Well, I can't just do sports. That's why I love Sports Illustrated, and I will give them so much credit because they let me do non-sports when I want to do non-sports because I just think every sport, we are sports fans. I don't want to come across like we're not sports fans. Obviously, we're big, huge sports fans, but every sports fan has other interests. You know, you just can't be focused on that one thing. And as I get older, too, like those, you know, now, you know, when I would say I would have other interests, I would say, you know, TV, music, movies, but now it's obviously more serious stuff. And, I do feel like this might be a little bit of a weird transition, but we've sort of teased it a little bit. But, you know, the mental health crisis in this country is sort of been put in the forefront in recent years. And I feel like it's become a really big part of the sports world. And I feel like you've been one of the people sort of at the forefront of it.
Mm-hmm.
You discussed your anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think when you sort of came out publicly with the full story, it was after the birth of your first child.
Yeah.
And were you having anxiety before that, or it all started then?
Surely I had what was anxiety now that I can now say that.
Right.
I had a charge to me. I mean, I was squeezing every ounce out of life.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, I think every around the horn, ask Solomon and Bard, was a Scorsese level movie for me.
Right.
All right. He makes a movie a year. I was making 230 episodes along with Solomon and Bard and, of course, our great panel. But I was treating every episode. I was processing it in a different way. I was lost in work. I certainly had an exercise addiction. I certainly had a food addiction
When you say exercise addiction,
I mean, I needed to work out 2.5 hours a day, 2 hours a day. This is before kids. This is when I'm, I'm still with, Sammy, of course. But I mean, we didn't have a family at that point.
I was doing
CrossFit to the point of exhaustion because that was the type. I mean, CrossFit for me was a way that I could end every, the only way I could ever be tired in life.
Mm-hmm.
That's the type of energy I was accustomed to my whole life, you know, and I finally found something that could drop me at the end of a workout at least for an hour. So I was chasing that type of exhaustion in life, but I didn't recognize what that was. I thought it was because, hey, I'm
energetic.
I want to be fit. I'm an energetic guy. I need this. I had problems sleeping, of course, but I think, you know, so many people in all industries who are just focused on their work will have that. I recognize that my job had stresses, but I never had a problem performing for a red light or never really had the fear that I was going to say something to get me fired, which a lot of people did.
Mm-hmm.
But it hit me pretty hard when I recognized it. It was being a parent.
Yeah.
And I want to say this. I mean, I was talking to Ramona Shelburne about this, my friend and colleague who is currently on maternity leave, but she wrote an article in advance of her maternity leave where she talked about Serena Williams, Candace Parker, some of the prominent female athletes. But I don't really, I mean, of course, every woman will have an entirely different and more magnified perspective of what being a parent is. And I say that absolutely respectfully, more magnified. But it is something that changes your life. And if you try to avoid acknowledging what that is, and I don't think I was doing that, but that's part of it. But also viewing it how it can enhance your life as a professional.
Mm-hmm.
It makes you a more complete person. It just will. I don't want to sound like I'm preachy to people who haven't decided to make the plunge to be parents yet or that's not where their direction is in their life. And, of course, that's fine. But it opens up a whole lot of parts of your personality and your person and your humanity that you were not giving as much light to initially. for me, when that happened, the anxiety came out a hundredfold. And so many of the things that I was keeping in metastasized into something worse. And this is where I had a very pronounced anxiety attack that, you know, through some work with a therapist, can be called postpartum anxiety. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a little bit late in the window. And of course, male postpartum does exist. And I've done, you know, plenty of research on this and exactly what it is. And I'm still not sure exactly what it needs to be labeled, but I don't need to label it.
Right.
I recognized what it was. My entire life was being a duck, floating above water, looking chill, looking cool. And underneath that water, I was paddling like a mofo.
But you didn't know that's what was going on.
I didn't know. I didn't recognize. I thought that I was a dude who needed to have control over what he was eating, to the point where I was having food poisoning on the regular and trying to monitor a diet where I would go vegan for months at a time, which would then give me kidney stones because I consumed too many.
Vegan,
I know this
on.
Was and this is the hilarity of my life. I'm attracted to, and I bring on stories that are complete roller coaster rides. Depending on if I'm getting engaged in between the men's and women's bathroom at LaGuardia Airport, which I did, or if I'm, you know, going vegan and then giving myself kidney stones. This is an example of somebody who's trying too hard.
Yeah.
You're doing too much. You're grasping for something. You're trying to be too happy. You're trying to be too perfect. You're trying to be a lot of things. This is not unique to me.
Right.
But when I recognized it happening, I recognized I had a platform, and I'm so proud of DeMar DeRozan and Kevin Love. Guys, I don't know at all.
Right.
But of their ability also, where a spotlight is so much brighter on them. I mean, Do I think people watch a television host at home and think, oh, there's somebody who I want to be like, or there's a role model? No. I mean, there's somebody on TV who I like the way they
host the show.
Yeah. Okay, fine. That's great. But we can't get confused that athletes and many of other types of celebrities are, in fact, what people put in their mind's eye of who they idealize as, who they want to be.
Right.
And I think what they've done has been incredible.
Oh, yeah. Kevin Love especially.
And this is so recent, Jimmy.
Yes, that's what,
Larry Sanders, the Milwaukee Bucks, 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. Royce White out of Iowa State, 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah.
We weren't ready, and I recognized what that was. And that was still, that predated me slightly, or maybe Larry Sanders was right as I was going through it.
Right.
When I had my light bulb moment that I was dealing with something, and here was how I was going to treat myself. I was going to put in the effort through talk therapy.
Well, so
I wasn't going to leave things unexplored, but I was also going to project that outward.
Right.
For
so
me, that's what I needed to
when
do.
When you had that first anxiety, that you knew you were having anxiety postpartum, when you were, did you get help right away?
I called the hotline first thing in the morning, and they put me on hold and called me back 2 hours later.
That's a cold line. That's not a hotline.
Was a postpartum anxiety. I mean, that was a sleepless night.
Yeah.
I mean, I can remember the exact moment. It was my wife does work in Africa. She works in business and in emerging markets. She was in Nigeria at the time, which she will be for weeks at a time. This was not her first trip away. Mm-hmm. I had certainly watched Francesca and all her friends for play dates weekends at a time. And I was at that moment, you know, read something bad on Twitter. I'm somebody who's an empath. I've recognized what that means. Mm-hmm. I'm somebody who lacks a buffer sometimes. And I read something really bad in the news. And that stuff affects me. And that's why I have to recognize how the news affects me every day.
Right.
And not...
But you didn't know that at the time.
You
learn all this afterwards.
I learned that afterwards. Right. And now I've learned since then.
Right.
That doesn't mean shutting it down. That doesn't mean not hearing things.
It means dealing with it, giving voice
to what that is.
Because I do think, because I've talked about having anxiety and you don't know, you know, when you first had, I mean, I had my first ever anxiety attack that I remember here. Yeah. And I thought I was having a heart attack because the symptoms are so similar.
Right.
And so, you know, I'm not shy about talking about anxiety. I'm not constantly talking about it, but whenever you do talk about someone who may have anxiety, I'm still surprised how many people though will say like, oh, I get anxiety attacks, I have panic attacks, and I'll say, you know, are you speaking to someone, are you in therapy, and they'll say no, I don't need, and it's, you know, it's there's still so many people I feel like who don't take that step, which is so needed and so necessary.
I mean, talk to the people I talk to on a regular basis, my friends. I mean, they're tired of me saying that.
Oh,
you know. I mean, it's to the to the point of you have to give voice to those feelings, because if you don't, they're inside you. They stink around, and like I said, they metastasize. Yeah. And when they come out as something completely different.
Right.
It's the scene in Jurassic Park when they figure out we needed to use frog DNA to finish the sequence here, to mm-hmm. build these dinosaurs. And then what happened? Frog DNA was able to morph into something else, and then right. the dinosaurs were able. It's a Jurassic Park scenario is what I call it.
Yeah.
When you provide information that's either not accurate, or you provide information that is something you project or something that you've just created and imagined in your own mind, and then you've gone on and done reality knowing that.
Yeah.
And reality becomes to be less real. And then you built a straw man in a lot of ways. I think it's giving voice to those things is important. Not everybody is always there at every moment. But we are talking about something. We're talking about anxiety. We're talking about mental health. We're talking. We're just talking about life.
Right.
We're just talking about humanity. So in destigmatizing a word, I want to name it, because when you name something, you have power over it. But I also want to define it and not just say this is anxiety for people. Mm-hmm. This is life for people. Mm-hmm. And when we stop thinking about it as, you know, one in X people have anxiety, and we realize 10 in 10 people will have moments in their life where they need to process things differently than they always have. They need to get out of their comfort zone of how they process things.
Right.
They need to give voice to things in a way, and by just giving it that type of air and volume. You see what this
yeah.
is? The hilarity of this is I work on a show with a mute button, and I turn all people's voices.
Right.
And what I was talking about this
about
show
sports.
Is a wink.
That's about
the show,
sports.
Right, but the show is a wink. The show is better referential. But the goal is to amplify those voices.
Yeah.
And the goal in your own life is to amplify your voices. So when I was going through something when Francesca was born, I recognized early on I had to give voice to what that is. And then I realized I was the type of person that needed to share it. This last summer, we wanted to talk 8 months ago, Jimmy. And then 6 months ago, Sam and I lost Amadeo. And had to give birth to Enzo premature, and mm-hmm. we had Enzo in the NIC unit for weeks, and you know, the first baby we could hold was Amadeo, because we couldn't even put our arms around Enzo, because mm-hmm. he was hooked up to so many tubes. And we went through a moment that is very real for a lot of people in life. And we had to recognize.
And a moment other people can't even relate to.
And other people you can't relate to.
Yeah,
and in a moment, I'll even say this,
that
I could never have handled if I was who I was 5 years ago,
right.
pre-having my first child,
right.
pre-recognizing my own ebbs and flows of anxiety, the gravity of what all that is. And my wife and I, of course, and we've talked about this, and I had to talk to her in advance of before going public, mm-hmm. because this is, you know, something that the stakes are very high, and I want to be both respectful but also protective of my wife. She needed to process it in one way. The way I felt like I needed to process it was projecting it out,
mm-hmm.
was imparting it, was allowing people to see what it was a human was going through. Something other humans have gone through,
mm-hmm.
But a moment that what grief can be. I experienced a lot of things in June of this year, and it, a lot of it was an incredible amount of support from people, which was not the design, but is a wonderful part of right. what humanity is.
And it's not grief in a way. I think, you know, you hear the word grief, everyone's been through their grief, whatever levels of it, but you have this grief where you lose a son, but then there's the joy of having
right and that's that so, was a gift that we, Sam and I and Francesca, had that other families didn't have.
Yeah.
I mean, all of it is work and is a process. My process was I demanded or asked Aaron and Josh to come back to work a little bit sooner, because I was taking the bereavement, because I wanted to come back the day after Father's Day, because this is
right.
about Father's Day. And again, I can't stress enough, this is a sports show with a mute button.
Yeah, but when you're on
system.
TV, as long as you're on TV and you're the right. host of a show, people automatically get invested in something like that. I mean, there's just...
I knew the type of television I want to make, the type of television I want to watch, demands that type of authenticity. I went through moments in my TV where I had the garbage bag underneath the desk as I was going through kidney stones, and I was maybe cowering in the commercial break. Right. And the second the camera went on, I was giggling and laughing, and I was going to cut away if I needed to vomit because I had the kidney stone at that moment. That's faking it.
Yeah.
I thought there was a certain amount of pride that I could fake it on TV, and the viewer would always go away thinking, that guy's having the best day.
Right.
I found out that that was actually another example of my exercise addiction, my food addiction, my gripping life too much. I found out I was viewing myself as the object of someone else's sentence rather than the subject of my own. I was chasing the viewer's response to what I was doing.
Interesting, yeah.
Rather than the authenticity of what I was doing.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
And that gives power away to somebody. So having experienced that and the recognition I made, like I said, I would never have been able to handle losing a child.
Right.
And no parent may be ever able to handle what that is. But I was able to work through my process by voicing what it was, working through therapists at the hospital, working with my own personal
therapist. Did you ever have a time where you thought you wouldn't go back to work?
No.
Okay.
No. I knew that I was going to be somebody who was going to need work, mm-hmm. need work in the proper light, and that's what it is for me. Being a parent can enhance, even a grieving parent, enhance who you are as a person in your profession, whatever it is,
yeah.
But certainly in a profession where you communicate for a living.
Again, like getting back to what you do, you know, when you go through something like that, from, you know, do you really then care who wins the World Series? You know what I mean? It's but you almost need that stuff, I would assume.
Yeah,
to
I
get
mean
you through things
again.
To,
caring who wins the World Series for me, I'm now watching sports, and you addressed this before.
Yeah.
I'm watching sports for different reasons.
Right.
I was as big a sports fan as anyone in the world, and I knew every piece of information, and I lived for those moments
you
and
were
those
called Stat Boy.
Wins and losses. And my evolution as a sports fan has been just as stunning to me as my evolution
right.
as a person.
Right.
I mean, my favorite and greatest sports moments now are sports moments I would never have considered to even think to be. I don't know if I liked the Olympics growing up. I can't make it through a broadcast Olympics without crying now. Jason Lezak touching the wall before Alain Bernard in the race where the relay where Phelps was able to keep his dream alive.
Right.
That's the greatest sporting event of my life in my brain right now. I watch that on a weekly basis.
Right.
You can go to my YouTube library. There's Peppa Pig for Francesca and all these piano tutorials for Don't Stop Me Now by Queen. And then there's Jason Lezak.
Right.
And it's the call, the incredible call of that. I'm also attached to it as a sportscaster. It's Rowdy
right.
Gaines and Dan Hicks screaming, Lezak's done it. I mean, Derek Redmond going back a few other Olympics and his father coming out and carrying him across. That's the humanity of sports. That's the humanity that maybe Around the Horn can't get into right now, but my next show most certainly will on the regular.
Right.
So that's the evolution of myself as a sportscaster, my evolution of myself as a man, as a father, as a human, recognizing that I had an opportunity. I wanted to be on the show. I needed work to process through what I was doing.
Right.
My wife was not the same way, and we needed to be respectful of what that was. But I needed a moment at the end of the show to kind of complete my process and project it outward.
Right.
Because that experience that I had been through, grief is above all things something everyone experiences. Yet again, like anxiety, it is life. Not mm-hmm. part of life. Grief is life. Mm-hmm. Anxiety is life. And demonstrating one way to process grief. One way a father can process grief, a parent can process grief, but not for everybody. One way an 18 to 25-year-old can process grief who are watching our show at the time. That was in my thoughts, and that's why I needed to do the show that day.
Right. It would be such a cliche question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Just we talked about the sports angle of it, but you go through a tragedy like that. Has it changed you? Does it change you?
Oh, of course.
I mean, in what ways? In terms of, is it? Do you think your relationship with the son you have is different because of the tragedy of
it. That will play out over time. This is really now grieving parents' story here. Mm-hmm. But when I was in the NIC unit and I was talking to the therapists on hand for the 2 weeks we were there, you know, in and out of nursing Enzo into health, and he is an incredibly healthy boy. He's got blue eyes, Jimmy. He's a little Sinatra. I don't know how we had an Italian Moroccan baby with blue eyes, but part of that was recognizing that I was going to have to explain to Francesca, a four-year-old who's now aware enough and incredibly smart, why we were coming home with one baby and not two, and she knew we were having twins all along.
Yeah.
And that, for me, after the initial dealing with it, was the toughest thing I was ever going to have to do in my life. So that was over three conversations, because it takes a while for a child. I immediately went home while we were still, of course, staying over the hospital overnight, and picked her up at school the first day. That was a tough conversation, and she avoided it as a four-year-old would. And the second conversation was equally tough, but with a little bit of tears. And then the third conversation was devastating.
Yeah.
And has it changed me? That conversation and that moment and that inflection point has changed my entire life.
Right. You probably have this protection thing now that's, I mean, every parent has an insane protection thing for their children, but I can imagine
it. But here's how it changed my life. Yeah. Here's what happened in that. With some guidance from me in the work that I did with therapy in advance of it, it ended after many tears and why can't he be born? Was drawing a family portrait of our now family of four, and then one angel flying into the sky. Francesca put wings on baby Amadeo. Mm-hmm. And that process there of a four-year-old grieving through play, grieving through art, and how she lifted all of us up is what's changed my life.
Yeah.
It's what's changed my life as a man, as a father, as a human in the world, and how I told you, I'm somebody who sees the world possibly through other people's eyes in a way that leaves me too vulnerable, mm-hmm. or leaves me too much lost in certain scenarios. But that, and again, I don't want people who are listening to this to think of the view I am giving around the horn here, the show with the mute button, the scoring system. But it's how I view, you know, the world. It's changed how I view even stories. Not you know, name the jokiest story we've done recently. Of course not that.
Right.
I still live in a space where I can laugh. I still live in a space where I love to laugh at the video of the mascot getting hit, know, with the ball.
Right.
All that. That's not landing there, but there are other stories that is landing there.
Yeah.
They just are, you know. We can talk about Ohio State's last 6 months. That story is landing there, you know. We can talk about any number of players who are dealing with redemption stories. That has opened my eyes to maybe a more fullness of the full human.
Yeah.
Condition, if I could say that without sounding grandiose.
No, it makes total sense. It's interesting to me that you never had a moment where you thought not to come back to work, or maybe, I mean, it shows too how, just to get back to that day-to-day grind, that day-to-day
That's
routine.
Who I am because of maybe how I was raised. That's going to be true for some people and not true for other people. Yeah. And, you know, I think of, you know, some of my other friends, and I've heard from so many people. I've heard from people in the street. I've heard from people, of course, over Twitter. And it was hard to I needed people to know that I heard all their messages.
The response to that was
of course what it was.
Yeah.
I mean, I wasn't doing it for the response, but I knew it was going to be
right.
a natural result of something like that. It's an example that, of course, this is here. Of course, this is real. Of course, people have to go through this. They have to go through much worse.
Right.
And they still have to go on.
Right.
You still have to go on. Life is going on. You know, that's where the work has to be. But you have to put in work to do that. And that's the message I'm trying to pass on to people also. Yeah. There are ways to voice this. There are ways to process this. It also requires work.
Yes.
And it's scary to put in work. It's uncertain to put in work. But it's better to put in work than to let it be kept down and then come at another point at the expense of your own person, your own humanity, your own relationships in life.
Right. And I think the other thing that's important, not to get all preachy, but I think what's important too is if someone's listening to this and they have any issues with anxiety or panic attacks or a grieving process, how everyone gets through it is also different. And the timing is different and how you handle it is different. I think the only thing that maybe you'd agree or disagree that is universal is just don't hesitate to seek out help, get help, talk to someone, get therapy. If you could take someone, you know, when I was unemployed for a year, I had depression so bad I was in bed for like 2 weeks at a time. And like, but other people have it for like a year. It's everyone has.
Let me ask you this: your relationships in your life,
yeah,
how have they changed since you sought help?
Well, I mean, the relationships.
Some
in my
got
life
more
are,
difficult. Although, some got better. Some, but
right, because there are some relationships you have to
distance yourself from,
right,
or reprioritize
exactly
in how you do it. You
in
cannot
you deal with, yes,
throw yourself into a relationship that is at your expense.
Right.
But you just said something that struck me. Tim Kalisha, who I admire as a sports writer and panelist on the Around the Horn to the, you know, to the most, but I'm in awe of as a man and his struggle with alcohol addiction. And this was happening during Around the Horn. Tim wrote about this in his book, Drunk on Sports. Mm-hmm. He was stages of hungover to the point of not on our pre-show meetings, was never on air in an incapacitated state, I believe, but he certainly was in one that was less than his usual self.
Right.
He had blackouts. He had terrible injuries to his skull because of his blackouts. He talks about all this, and I'm in awe of him talking about all this. But he is also somebody who has done it himself. And that's, for him, that was something he could do. Mm-hmm. So I am the biggest proponent of seeking help and giving voice to your, but giving voice to your feelings is a way, and giving voice to what his addiction was the way he beat it. So
right.
For me, I don't even know if I can profess how to do it. I profess how I did it and profess which way is a way to do it, you know?
Yeah, and that's that. I think that was what I'm trying to say. Is every situation is different. Every person goes through it differently, handles it differently. It's just a matter of just deal with it. That's really the only, you know.
I was thinking
aside
about Anthony Bourdain recently, and Anthony Bourdain died by suicide the same week we were going through our personal tragedy. So I never really, and I loved Anthony Bourdain, I never really considered it. I never really thought about what it was, and then his name came up in a discussion recently, and that was the first time I really dove in into what it was. And this was a person who seemed like he'd been through life, that he'd been on the outside after fighting for so long. This was a person, of course, who demonstrated his desire to explore the world externally and internally. He was putting in the work. He was going through whatever process he decided was his process. And it still took him.
And
the demonstration there is just how tough this is for people when we're dealing with mental health and we're dealing with traumas that are thrown at people, the ones that are by their own doing. And we can say that could be true, but I would argue some of these by their own doing are still out of their control because we're dealing with a brain disease. Yeah. We're dealing with addiction.
Yeah.
And the ones that are not by their own doing, a trauma that is completely out of your control. And the fight was too tough for him. Mm-hmm. And that takes my breath away.
Well, I do. It takes. Yeah. I'm hoping one of the things people are realizing now with mental health becoming a big story in this country is someone like that. The role social media has in this, where you get surprised by someone going through struggles because they can throw out a joke on Twitter or
I'm glad you brought this up.
You know, it's very, you know, like I said, when I was unemployed, I had a couple of weeks there. I couldn't even get out of bed. But, you know, you throw one tweet out there making fun of A-Rod and everyone thinks you're fine. Or you post an Instagram of, you know, the meal you
We see this
ate.
over and over again. This is Kate Fagan's book, another one of my dear friends and someone I admire so much as a sports writer and as a writer, but I'm in awe of as a person, and her own personal journey through life and how she has now lived an existence where her heart is outside of her chest, is an expression I like to use, which is to show how much of yourself you're putting out there. And the book she wrote, What Made Maddie Run, which delves in this completely, Jim.
Yeah.
This is somebody who and this is something that the youngest generation out there now are dealing with, and we're seeing the repercussions of it. What a constant barrage of images that are, of course, filtered and photoshopped to the way that they're the most extreme, blissful. Again, this is the duck. The duck looking so cool. I like the way ducks look.
I'm
using duck. You could use a swan, a flamingo. I like ducks. Looking so cool above the water and never showing behind the curtain what reality of the life is, and people then begin chasing that other person's false existence. And, of course, Maddie Holleran and dying by suicide as well. From what was complications of how she saw herself and how she processed it through how other people were projecting who they were in the world. So this is something that I know is out there for people, and I know is something that does not necessarily connect to every sports story in the world, every story in the world, but it's something that is in the back of my head as I am processing through our stories of the day. And we're dealing with the World Series now, and the MVPs of the World Series are Pierce and it could have been Price, and they were two guys who were going through redemption in different ways. You know, Price so publicly failing in the biggest stage, and that's a story now that is dealing with his own humanity, whereas Price's redemption, I think, is solely on a baseball field because some of his other parts of his personality and how he dealt with things publicly in the media, I'm not sure he's fully addressed what that has been. But Pierce, having been through eight different ball clubs and getting his moment now and rising to an occasion, that's humanity too in sports. That's how I now see sports in the world.
That'll be the new show.
That'll be the new show. That'll and the new show. The new show is going to be a lot of things.
All right. But still on the old show, though, and we're going to transition here. We'll wrap this up with a couple of we'll go light now. Was the Goodfellas parody the highlight?
This wasn't light enough for you?
Was the Goodfellas parody the highlight of your career?
The Goodfellas parody was.
You loved that.
Was I think the reason why I got the business, Jimmy? I thought about that for years beforehand.
You must have known on day one.
I knew I needed the right set. I knew I needed something that looked like the Copacabana set where I could walk through. And we changed studios in D.C. about 6 years in when we went to HD. And I did one walk through the studio. I'm like, I got it. And I walked to work with the crystals in my ear. And then he kissed me, which was 2 minutes. And I want to get this right, 25 seconds. And I paced my walk in the way that Leota was walking. I mean, I talk about being lost.
I was too deep in there.
Slipping the cash, of course, needed to be done every time. Your hands don't look like they work in construction. All those lines. But it was actually the pace of the walk. It was everything I'm talking about. But I didn't realize it. It was pulling back the curtain and showing really how this person's life was. I'm doing that now in emotional ways. I'm doing that now in maybe more serious ways. I was doing
it back then.
And this is how a TV show gets put together. Absolutely the highlight of my creativity.
Is that your all-time favorite movie?
Of course. Yeah. No, not even close. Nothing touches that.
Yeah.
That's I think, a movie anybody can sit down and watch from the moment it's on. I could sit down and watch and quote from the moment it's on.
Yeah.
I think I see the beauty in it. I see the characters in it. I like characters. I don't necessarily want characters on Around the Horn. I don't want my panelists to be characters per se, but I want them to be relatable uncles that you remember from other people in your life.
Well, those are some uncles.
Those are some uncles. Yeah. But we all know those people. I mean,
we do. You mentioned all the Fordham guys.
Yeah.
What were your other influences getting into the business? Was it just the Fordham guys?
I mean, first and foremost, it was the Fordham guys.
Yeah.
Chris Carino calls the Nets,
yeah.
And while I was at Fordham, maybe the first month there, we did a walkthrough of his, I think he was at WOR at the time, and I gave him a wave, and I was able to get a wave back, and he talked to me a little bit, and I think he remembered me. And at this point, you know, Chris, I posted him and his son and his wife at Around the Horn recently, and really pitched his son hard on my high school in New Jersey, and right. We have that type of relationship now at that point. Michael Kay came out to a Fordham game early on, called the Yankees, you know, I got to meet him at that stage. Mike Breen, I think, is among the great play-by-play guys in the business. Right. Bob Papa. I was around those guys. So I really fell for those guys. Growing up, who did I love? I loved Pa Pinstripe. I loved John Sterling.
Oh, okay.
I mean, that lived in my, at least in my teenage world, the type of
But when we were growing up, he wasn't
energy.
What he is now.
Like, no, but the Bernie Williams home run in 96 against the Orioles.
That's what started it all, was the Burn.
Yeah,
Baby Burn.
Baby Burn started it all. And I liked that he was able to bring that much personality into a broadcast.
Right.
That's what got me in trouble at Fordham and Marty Glickman and Spiro Dittus, my broadcast partner, who's with CBS calling NFL games on Sundays and March Madness games in the tournament, you know, didn't necessarily bring that to the table in his call, but I brought those in my calls, and maybe that's what got me out of play-by-play, but got me into a space where I could be the host I am. And here's something I tell all people who want to break into the business, you know. The job you might have in 10 years, 15 years, does not exist now. Jimmy, this job didn't exist for you when you were cutting your teeth and some of the best transcribed articles the world had ever seen sportsSI.com or whatever it was at the time. It doesn't exist. It doesn't exist 10 years from now. It doesn't exist.
Yeah.
You know, TV might not exist in 15 or 20 years. I think it will, but it will exist like a newspaper exists now. And I've seen it with all my friends, Woody Page and Bill Plaschke, who are still at newspapers. But, you know, Frank Isola, who's now made the jump. I mean, Frank Isola delivered the New York Daily News.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
He wrote the frontline New York Daily News for now. He's at the Athletic,
and he was there in the glory days of the Knicks when they were
yeah, those
a
glory
real
days
team
when they
team.
Well, yeah, that glory day.
Riley
I think it was.
No, the Riley Van Gundy years were. They had.
I always have to be the sound of reality there to kind of bring the Knicks down.
What about non-sports influencers? Any of those, like in broadcasting? Did any who?
That's a good question. As interviewing style, because now that I live in a moderator,
or hosting, moderating.
I think I would go with recent influences. Mark Maron and Anthony Bourdain changed the way I viewed myself as a host. Mm-hmm. And then one more, maybe you've heard that from people before, one more that nobody will ever tell you, Cesar Millan.
Really?
The dog whisperer of dog whisperers.
Yeah. What did you take
this from him? Is going to sound terrible, but the way he showed command, when I was in my mid-20s hosting Around the Horn, I wasn't fearful, but I was overwhelmed with how I was going to mute Bob Ryan in the freaking Basketball Hall of Fame.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Jackie McMullen in the Basketball Hall of Fame. And Bill Plaschke, the seven-time Sports Columnist of the Year nationally. How was I going to mute these guys?
Right.
Bomani Jones, Pablo Torre, I have no problem slapping a mute on them. Israel Gutierrez, you know. But how was I going to get around that? How was I going to demonstrate that I was up to it? And I was going to do it in a couple of ways. One was going to be tonally. You know, I was going to be a smart aleck, and I was going to play from the stat boy card that I already had. I can do that. I already did it with Tony and Mike, who have the accolades, of course, as well. But Cesar Millan showed that you can demonstrate, you know, command and authority while doing a couple different things physically on camera. I changed the way I sat in my chair. I was going with a lean the first 5 years, which was ridiculous. Can't even go back and look at that. And also just as terse as you can be, as short as you can be,
you
as directly
lean,
as you can be.
You were going to lean.
Oh, I was leaning like I was driving a Corvair in the 1970s.
Lean back is no good
on TV? It looked like I was too relaxed.
Okay.
I was purposefully. I was trying to demonstrate I was relaxed.
Yeah,
I thought that was
the
way in, but I realized I was coming off a little bit. I looked like I was uncomfortable, honestly. I mean, it looked like I was about to tip over at any moment. So Mark Maron in the way he approached it so conversationally and Anthony Bourdain in the way he found a common thread, which of course was food, but I could find it through sports and through the humanity at all. And Cesar Millan, the way he worked with dogs, because if you can work with dogs, you can work with sports writers.
So, maybe. Sports writers.
That's
could
a
be,
joke.
Writers could be a little more temperamental than dogs.
Yeah,
I think. A little bit. All right. Let's let's do it properly. The Around the Horn relaunch.
The Around the Horn relaunch.
November 5th.
November 5th.
What do you want to explain?
We're out of South Street Seaport, and here's the my quick story for you that I haven't given anybody else, Jimmy.
Okay.
So it is. So Pier 17 is where South Street Seaport is.
Right.
All right. I grew up in a New York City family. I was born in Staten Island. I was raised in Jersey. I wanted to come back to New York my whole life. It was why I left PTI, which was among the toughest decisions of my life.
Anywhere but in New York.
Yeah, I mean, maybe. I was in D.C. for a decade, and leaving PTI was another panic attack that I had that night when I made the decision. I made the decision to come to New York. It was a life decision. I was going to have the ability to do some Good Morning America, which I did for the last 4 years, primarily on weekends the last 3 years. But it was about a life decision. I wanted to raise a New Yorker.
Yeah.
I wanted to get back here. I wanted my wife to live this lifestyle. We're filming now on Pier 17. My two grandfathers unloaded bananas from boats on Pier 17 70 years ago. All right? There's a lot of money in banana boat.
I'm surprised your grandfathers were here. I would have thought they would be.
No, they're the generation before that.
Okay.
So they settled down in the Lower East Side, and they settled down in Lower Manhattan, and they dropped out of school. I want to get this right, in about sixth grade, seventh grade, and they were best friends growing up. Grandpa Jimmy, who was Vincenzo, but his speak the name right, and
my
then
grandfather,
it became Jimmy.
That's my middle name.
Oh, is that right?
James Vincent.
Oh,
my
wonderful.
My grandfather was Vincent James.
Oh, great. And Grandpa Frank. And I have a Francesca and Francesca and an Enzo. But they were best friends growing up. They played ball in the yard. And they played ball in the lots together, you know, in the street. One grandfather hit a ball into a group of girls, broke a nose. The other grandfather took her to the hospital. He said, "You better go visit that girl. You broke her nose." Grandpa Frank went to the hospital after Grandpa Jimmy told him. And that's Grandma Marie, Grandpa Frank's wife. That's how they went back, all right? So best friends growing up. Dropped out of school, unloaded bananas from boats, and I don't think you got the Arrested Development reference. There's
no,
a lot of money in a banana boat.
Right.
When they were in their mid-teens, and now I'm working from the same freaking pier, doing something slightly different.
Full circle.
That's an incredible.
That's incredible.
That's an incredible.
Yeah.
I believe in that. I love that. I love that. My grandma's house. Was five blocks from where my studio is now. We're going to be in the South Street Seaport studio, the studio that we share with First Take, where we're filming Get Up and High Noon. Pablo and Bomani, my boys, are going to be right across the hall from me, and Katie Nolan's filming there every week, and of course, the radio shows, Jalen and Jacoby are there as well, and Stephen A., doing his radio, and it's great to be in an office that's got that much energy and it's got that much history for me. And I'm going to be filming Around the Horn in augmented reality, Jimmy, which I might not be the expert to tell you this, but I got cameras with most systems on top of it that somehow correspond with the dots, you know, those little dots that people wear when they make video games?
Yeah,
something similar to that. I mean, I'm sure Alex Tyner and Mike Foss and John Dersey are technical directors who've done an incredible job throughout all of this, can speak to this a little bit better, but somehow they're communicating with those dots above that. There's 150 dots in the ceiling, and they're working with the cameras, and they are allowing the plasmas, which exist now, to be visuals of the guys jumping out of the screen. And I'm going to be able to pull the guys closer to each other and really get them face-to-face, which is going to, in my mind's eye now, maybe get them too close to the camera, but get them in a place where the debate is going to be enriched, and we're going to have those moments where it's two guys, three guys going after each other, and we're going to have graphics be able to jump out at the screen, and we are going to be standing up, and I'm having a desk that looks like it's a Chris Pine desk. We're going to unleash the raw athleticism of reality, Jimmy. and then that fourth layer is going to be very viewer engagement based. We're going to immerse the viewer in the augmented reality, and we're going to engage them on the app, which is going to allow for scoring at home and some more debates.
It's all about the apps these days.
And the behind the horns that people tell me are better than the show, and they think they're doing a little insult, and I say that's the greatest compliment.
It's same channel, same time spot.
Same channel, same time spot. Happy hours in full existence. It's now a happy 2 hours with High Noon and Highly Questionable, and then Horn and PTI weekdays on ESPN.
That PTI is amazing. It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's going and going.
Both of us. I mean, it's a combined 7,000 episodes.
Yeah.
3,601 episodes for Around the Horn. Think of a show on television that's done that, and they haven't.
Monday Night Raw, that's about it. I think that's like the longest running show.
Doesn't get there though, because it's only Monday night. Because we're a daily. We're a daily. 60 minutes doesn't get there. We're a daily.
Right.
So SportsCenter's there, but a debate show, a show of a talk show of that nature.
Right.
And it's not there.
What about Kelly Ripa?
Kelly Ripa has been on TV a lot. We'll check the numbers
on
that.
If Regis was still on that show.
Yeah, that show has now relaunched and changed.
Yeah, they have so many hosts.
And for me, of course, being a survivor in the industry is great.
Yeah.
But this Around the Horn show is getting what it's earned. It's right. never gotten the respect it's deserved. The initial reviews of the show were what they were. But the evolution of this show is, I think we just set the record for longest podcast. Yeah, I think I just passed John Cena. So we have earned this in a way that we're extremely proud of. The evolution of the show has been real. And anyone who doesn't really acknowledge what that is, I'm happy to give you exactly what that is. We have gone to HD. We have changed the way we score the show. We made it about the panelists instead of about the host, which was the initial installment of the show when Max was hosting. We have added representation and voices in a way that no other show on television has the representation we have. No other show on television has the equity in voices and the diversity of voices. And yes, the diversity of opinion and voices. People want to come in and pick three or four voices that they know to be of one certain side. Nobody's of every single side.
Right.
Everybody sees the world differently.
Right.
Centrist voices, conservative voices, and liberal voices all exist on Around the Horn, whether you like it or not.
I don't know if you want to sell it that way with liberal. Those words are like poison now, liberal and conservative.
I have no qualms being real on the reality of what the world is now.
Yeah.
I know what we are as a show. And this is yet another evolution of the show that we haven't seen from other television shows. Another example, Around the Horn is not only a survivor, but thriving.
Well, I'm looking forward to checking it out, and I really thank you for coming in, and I thank you for the conversation. You went to places you didn't have to go. I appreciate it, and I think what you're doing is
I'm
really
the person
important.
who's okay doing that.
Yeah.
Other people might not be there.
Right.
This is not a case study in how I should deal with my own anxiety at home, if you're listening. It's one way, please.
Right.
But be aware of what it is and give a name to what it is. It's anxiety. It's life. Or give a name to what it is. It's your stresses of your normal day. But they have an effect on you even if you think you're impenetrable.
Yep. All right. Thank you so much. Appreciate
another
it.
Handshake. You dominated me in that handshake.
Dominating.
Oh, you
All
broke
right.
me.
Thanks a lot, Tony.
Ciao.
Appreciate it. Tony Reale from Around the Horn, relaunch November 5th. All right, my thanks to Tony Reale for the time, the interview, the conversation, and his openness. Boy, if you don't like that guy, the problem's on you, not him. That's all I got to say about that. Appreciate him coming in, and very interesting conversation. That's all I can say about it. Hope you enjoyed it, and we'll see you next week right here on the SI Media Podcast. I'm your host, Jimmy Traina. Have a good one.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network, the number one daily sports podcast network? Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.